and never seen again."
Kibas's eyes widened. Someone was reaping children so close to him. Not only was he insulted at being ham-fistedly copied, but more rumors of children disappearing would eventually draw the attention of an enforcer, something Kibas could not afford. "No, perhaps there is a way to deal with this politically. Someone needed to take the blame for killing all these children after all. Why not shove the culpability onto the other reaper? After all, Kibas knew a judge that would be happy to apply legal pressure to someone. Who's running this orphanage?" Chapter 17. The Academy. Nancy.
"I don't like the scar test,"
Nancy griped, rubbing the burnt line of skin on the back of her hand.
"I mean, who does? But they numb it up first, so it doesn't hurt,"
Jake said, inspecting the back of his hand, which was perfectly clear of the brand. Jake had been there a full 3 weeks longer than she had, and he'd gotten used to the strangeness, but it gave Nancy the creeps. She still wasn't sure if Mr. Serpy was on the up and up.
"It hurts after," she muttered. "Once your body gets high enough, it doesn't hurt for very long,"
he responded, flopping over in his bed to look directly at her.
"And just think of all the amazing things we can do because Mr. Serpy has been helping us."
Jake reached out and grabbed his headboard and lifted his entire body off the bed, holding it parallel with one hand.
"I even got a class today,"
Jake said, setting himself down.
"I'm a pikeman now. It gave me +5 to my body." "What's a pikeman do?" "Well, from what I could read, it helps me poke things with spears,"
Jake said.
"Mr. Serpy suggested it."
Nancy shuddered at the mention of poking things with spears. She did not like killing the Robsy. They almost looked like rabbit people, and they sounded just awful when they died. That was why she started aiming for their necks. Other children had adapted quickly to the situation, even chatting and laughing while they tormented the creatures in the cages, but it still made Nancy sick. The only two reasons she killed them was because if she didn't, someone else would do it meaner, and because when she shied away from killing, all the Keegan guiding them would pay way too much attention to her. It reminded her of her mommy's expression shopping for fruit when she discovered a bruised peach. Nancy had never known how terrifying it would be for that expression to be directed at her, but it scared her into killing fuzzy rabbit men the same size as her. Not wanting them to hurt caused her to kill the Rabsy faster than the other children, so she had even more blood on her hands. She was already level 16, just a week or so behind Jake. She had the brand on the back of her hand that they had given her when she'd first started. It was definitely starting to fade. Maybe she and Jake could graduate to the next step at the same time. Nancy would give almost anything to be past killing Rabsy. There was a soft knock on the door, and Nancy and the other 7 children sat up, looking at the doorway. Keegan doorways were 9 feet tall on average, absolutely massive compared to the children themselves.
"All tucked in for bed, I see,"
Mr. Serpy said, folding his bony hands over each other as he entered.
"I apologize for disturbing your night, but tonight we're going to welcome a new member to the group and say farewell to another."
A scared little girl, even younger than Nancy, peeked out from behind his pant leg, clutching a stuffed rabbit to her chest.
"Oh, she's not going to do well."
Nancy wondered if Mr. Serpy even knew what the doll was supposed to represent.
"This is Marcy Evans. She'll be joining you."
"Hi,"
the little girl whispered, barely audible.
"And Jake Baker. I'm happy to announce that you have graduated from this step. Everyone, gather round and give Jake your well wishes. You won't be seeing him again until you join him in the next step, the Academy."
The children gathered around and gave Nancy's friend hugs and congratulations, talking and laughing excitedly. Mr. Serpy stood by patiently, his hands folded as he waited for the congratulations to die down.
"Come now, Mr. Baker,"
he said once the noise had quieted somewhat.
I have to show you to your tutor.
Okay, then,
Jake said with a shrug.
Going to school can't be much worse than stabbing Robsy all day. Can I come with?
Nancy asked, stepping forward, a nameless dread building in her chest as Jake headed for the door. Something about the door reminded her of a hungry mouth. Not the shape or the color, but the feel. She wanted to follow Jake and make sure he'd be okay with her own eyes.
No, the rest of you children must have your rest. It's a lot we ask of you, and you'll be needing all the rest you can get. Remember, this isn't goodbye forever. You'll be seeing him again in the academy in a few weeks.
Mr. Serpy said, gently taking Nancy by the shoulder and turning her back toward her bed.
I'll be fine,
Jake said, flexing his non-existent bicep and grinning before he followed Mr. Serpy through the door. And then they were gone. The other children clustered around the new girl, babbling excitedly as they caught her up to speed. The shy girl couldn't get a word in edgewise and seemed to be on the brink of crying from the information overload. Sitting on the edge of her bed and staring at the door, Nancy couldn't get it out of her head. Normally, she would whisk the little girl away from the overbearing boys and give her some space to breathe. But she was still thinking about Jake. She had been amazed to discover that Jake was still alive. And here. They all thought he'd been kidnapped. What were the chances that the same man saved them from the same bad guy and brought them here? Nancy had no idea, but something felt strange to her, and it made her stomach twist with nameless dread.
Maybe I can sneak out and say goodbye in person,
Nancy thought, standing up and heading for the door. She gently tugged on the latch and peeled the door open, looking around the edge of the wood.
Nothing but an empty hallway.
Nancy slipped out into the hall and went for the stairs, sneaking on her tiptoes. The door next to the stairs clicked open, startling ice into Nancy's skin. Amila's housekeeper backed out of the room before she could react and bumped into the girl, knocking her to the ground.
Oh? What's this?
She asked, turning around to view Nancy, clothes slung over her shoulder.
Little Nancy, is it? What are you doing out of bed? I'm getting something to drink.
Nancy lied.
Oh, I'll fetch it for you then,
the maid said, her tone sweet and gentle as she bent low to address the girl.
You run on back to your room and I'll grab a cart filled with water and snacks for you and your friends. Will that do? Yeah, that'll be fine,
Nancy said, unable to admit to wanting to sneak around. She headed back to the door and went back inside. Nancy snuck a peek over her shoulder as she entered the room and noticed that the Milas maid was still watching her, making sure she went back into her room. A shiver went down Nancy's neck as she shut the door behind her. Something felt wrong. Nancy didn't know what it was, but it felt like something was tightening around her and making it hard to breathe. She leaned against the door and slid down to her butt, breathing rapidly in and out as her heart began beating in her chest, like a caged animal trying to escape. Like a caged Robsy.
Nancy?
One of the boys, Richard, asked, coming closer to her and putting a hand on her forehead.
Are you okay? You don't feel like you have a fever. I don't know. I was going to go get a drink, and the maid bumped into me,
she said.
Yay, snacks!
Richard said, fist pumping. Nancy frowned.
How did you know she would bring snacks? When she bumped into me, she brought everyone snacks. Remember a couple of days ago? Oh yeah, when I ran into her, she brought snacks too.
Penny said, the dark-haired girl frowning thoughtfully before breaking into a smile.
Awesome.
Something felt wrong. It whirled inside her and Nancy put every ounce of focus she could into listening to her gut, slowly teasing out the dreadful question.
Did anyone ever get to the stairs?
The children glanced around at each other, shrugging and shaking their heads.
I guess not, Richard said. What does that mean? I don't know,
Nancy said, shaking her head.
It just feels wrong, like we're trapped here. But the door isn't even locked. Nobody's ever gotten past the stairs without running into the maid. Isn't that weird?
Nancy asked.
How could she accidentally run into everyone who tries to leave every time?
The children frowned and fell silent, not sure how to react.
Yo!
A boy named Thomas said, waving his hand from his bed.
Over here!
The blonde preteen lifted his heavy oak bed frame up and set it aside, revealing a trap door in the floor.
There was a girl a couple of weeks before me who could make anything into a door, he said with a shrug. I've been using it to explore the castle. Really?
Nancy crawled over to the door and ran her fingers over it. The smooth stone of the floor was marred by hinges and a stone knob. She twisted the handle and, with a smooth motion, the heavy block of stone lifted up, revealing a void colored black hole in the floor. Nancy couldn't get any sense of depth because the weak light from the room stubbornly refused to penetrate its depths. For a moment, she thought it was a doorway into death itself, until Penny brought a candle nearby, revealing a marble floor a few feet under the opening.
Jerk, Penny said, punching Thomas on the shoulder. This is the kind of thing you're supposed to share. It's the space between the floor and the rooms beneath us, Thomas said, rubbing his arm. Head straight that way and you'll get to the next door.
He pointed toward the side wall.
It leads to the roof. Thanks. No problem, kid. Don't act like you're a grown-up just because you're 10,
Penny said, punching Thomas's shoulder again.
Ow, quit it! Make me...
Penny stuck out her tongue.
I'll be back soon,
Nancy said, dropping into the pit and orienting on the direction Thomas had given her.
Oh, by the way, stick a piece of cloth or something in the roof door so that you can find it on the way back. Took me hours to find it again from the other side.
Thomas called after her.
Okay.
Nancy dropped to her knees and started crawling, the opening above her head shrinking into the distance until she couldn't see her hand in front of her face. After about 3 minutes of crawling through the dark, Nancy ran face first into stone, bopping her nose good.
Ow,
she whispered, rubbing her nose. She reached up and scanned the odd tilted stone with her hand until her fingers came across a handle. When she twisted it, the door revealed itself, spilling moonlight into the darkness. Nancy pried it open and clambered out onto the sloping shingles of the castle.
Gotta remember where this is,
Nancy thought, taking one of her twine bracelets and wedging it in the doorframe. She gently shut the shingle door and made her way to the edge. Nancy almost gasped at how beautiful everything was at night. The moon was huge and mottled pink and blue, casting a pale purple light over everything.
No, I can't stare at the pretty moon. I gotta see Jake again.
She just had to see him off. See him safe and okay. Then all her doubts would go away and she would be sure they were safe. Nancy creeped along the rooftop, keeping as quiet as possible and listening for anything that might tell her where Jake and Mr. Serpy had gone. She had spent a lot of time on the roof at her house, and it came naturally to her, especially now that she was a lot stronger than before. Her fingers clung to the shingles, each digit strong enough to carry her by itself. Nancy didn't know this, but a professional rock climber would have been insanely jealous before the stitching. Afterwards, the sport lost a bit of its luster. Suddenly, she heard voices. Nancy cocked her head and strained her ears.
Now, make sure you always address him as Sir, as he'll be your sponsor during your time in the academy. And once you graduate, you may be expected to work for him for a time. Think of it as a student loan repayment.
Got it.
She narrowed in on Jake's confident speech and began creeping in that direction. A moment later, she was hovering over Jake and Mr. Serpy as they walked toward the castle entrance through the courtyard. Jake was wearing Keegan-style robes, which must have been why she was able to catch up with them. She considered dropping down and saying goodbye in person, but she absolutely didn't want to get in trouble with Mr. Serpy, so she decided she would just watch for now. The front gate swung open, creating a path leading into the courtyard of the mansion/castle. A carriage drawn by a pair of matching black lizards with iridescent scales rolled inside, gliding silently on ivory wheels. The carriage came to a halt in front of Jake and Mr. Serpy where they were waiting. Jake copied Mr. Serpy and folded his hands, trying to act the part as best he could. A Keegan in a blue and black checkered robe stepped out of the carriage while his driver rested the prod on his knees, staring idly into the distance, nearly directly at Nancy, if a dozen feet too low.
"Lovely night, isn't it?"
the Keegan said, glancing up at the moon as he stretched.
"Indeed,"
Mr. Serpy said with a bow.
"Allow me to make formal introductions. Jake Baker, this is your sponsor, Judge Miraz Elcor. You will call him Judge Elcor or Sir. Judge, this is your sponsee, Jake Baker."
"Pleasure to meet you,"
Judge Elcor said, extending his hand. Jake seemed to reflexively go for a handshake, raising his hand, but the judge's reach extended beyond Jake's childish palm, landing a single finger on the boy's forehead. Crack! A blinding flash of greenish energy seared into Nancy's eyes, cutting out her vision. As Nancy was blinking tears out of her eyes, she saw Jake topple backwards, stiff as a felled tree. Jake's eyes were open, an expression of confusion frozen on his face. He was dead.
They killed him. No.
Nancy gasped before she slapped her hands over her mouth. Luckily, Mr. Serpy was shouting, like, a lot.
"What in the royal do you think you're doing?"
Mr. Serpy shouted.
"You're supposed to take him home."
"I'm expediting the process,"
Judge Elcor said, raising his chin, looking down at Mr. Serpy.
"Your rules are wasteful and poorly thought out, Mr. Ossett."
The Keegan paused, looking at something in the air.
"Although you do deliver results. Look at that, 5 whole levels from a single urchin. Magnificent. The rules are in place to protect you. You just committed a reaping, not an honor duel."
"Psht!"
Judge Elcor waved him off as he headed back toward the carriage.
"I haven't the time to tiptoe around the law. I am the law in Somnath. Other than your whining, I'm very impressed by the quality of your goods."
He stepped onto the carriage's step and glanced over his shoulder.
"Which is why I'll expect the next one a month from now."
"What next one?"
Mr. Serpy, a suit? asked, glaring at the judge.
"You've refused to follow the terms I've set down. I wouldn't take your money now if you begged me." "Oh, you won't be taking my money. Your payment will be my silence. Goodbye, Mr. Ossett."
Mr. Serpy watched the carriage circle around him, gracefully leaving the way it had come.
"Fuck! Damn these arrogant, mist-born sons of royal welted whores who've nothing between their ears but laziness and greed."
Mr. Serpy shouted at the top of his lungs once the drawbridge was closed.
"Jeopardize themselves, me and everyone else, because they want to cut a few corners. Idiots! Mist-addled fools!"
He turned towards her. Nancy dropped her face below the edge of the rooftop, hand clamped over her mouth. She felt hot tears trickle down the back of her palm, involuntary whimpers rising from her throat. Their captor continued shouting, drowning out Nancy's quiet sobs.
"Skull, take the boy and a shovel out into the wilderness and burn his body, clothes and all. If I find out you've lifted some of the silk for your wife, I will straight up murder you. Once he's bones, bury him deep, where scavengers can't get to him. I want plenty of time for the mist to be scattered into nature, so a seer can't read them. Right now!"
Mr. Serpy said, clapping his hands before stomping inside the castle.
"I have to leave right now."
If they found out she was out here, they would kill her, too. She had to get back to their room. Taking the opportunity, Nancy scrambled back across the rooftop, trying to locate the door back to the dark passageway leading to their room.
"There it is.
Nancy thought, spotting her bracelet, the white beads glowing faintly purple in the moonlight. She yanked the door open and slipped into the darkness as quickly and quietly as she could. The dark no longer held any fear for her. If Mr. Serpy couldn't see in the dark, then the dark was a good thing. She crawled back, her heart pounding in her chest, blindly trailing her fingers across the ceiling until she came across the seam of the door. Groping around, she found the handle, twisted it, then burst out into the children's room. "Nancy, are you okay? What happened?" Thomas asked as she shoved his bed back over the trap door, her breathing coming hot and fast. When the door was covered, Nancy sank to her knees and began bawling, not strong enough yet to tell them what had happened to Jake. What was going to happen to them? "Here you are. Snacks," the Milas maid said, bumping the door open with her hip, pulling a cart full of delicious meats and cheeses, along with a pitcher of water and several glasses. The dark orange woman paused when nobody cheered for snacks, pursing her lips when she noticed Nancy sobbing. "Oh dear, is she all right?"
"She, misses her mommy and daddy,"
Thomas said, patting Nancy's back.
Kabos Asut. The next morning, Kabos was pacing the courtyard, watching the children slaughtering the Rabzi in their cages in unusual but welcome silence. Even the talkative or particularly cruel children who seemed to enjoy hurting things were quiet, killing the vile creatures with unusually stoic expressions. "Well, they'll be back to their usual grating screams once they've forgotten about Jake." They did tend to get a little subdued when one of them left for their foster homes. But this was a little more than usual. Jake had been fairly popular among the children, from what he could recall. The only noise he heard was Marcy sobbing, which was not unexpected. The little girl was holding a spear several sizes too big for her and trembling like a leaf in front of a wounded Rabzi. Kabos thought he'd have to intervene as he had so many times before when a little girl didn't show a predilection for violence. But he was pleased to note Nancy was talking to the girl, guiding her to kill the Rabzi in the cage. He was too distant to make it out, but whatever she said must have worked, because in the end, Marcy stabbed the feral monster in the neck, ending its pitiful existence. Perhaps an inside man would help, Kabos thought, thumbing his chin as he observed. Many children took days to convince to kill the Rabzi, days that cut into his profit margin. Nancy had done it in less than an hour. During his patrol of the courtyard, something bright caught Kabos's gaze. Lying in the dirt on the edge of the grounds was a bracelet, sized for a child. He stooped to pick it up, studying its simplistic make. It was made of twine and ivory beads with black ink stamped onto them that spelled FRIENDS. Where could this have come from? Chapter 18. Plan C.
"Children," Zlesk whispered, clenching his fists. "This man you're hunting is reaping children?"
"Yeah, I mean, why do you think I started an orphanage?" Jeb asked, raising a brow. Zlesk's expressive brows furrowed in thought, then he shrugged.
"Because it was the right thing to do, obviously."
Jevin's smartass burst into laughter as Lesk looked progressively more and more pissed. "That's exactly the kind of attitude we look for in our faculty here at the Admiral Orphanage," Jeb said between gasps.
"You fat veek, you're using the children as bait?"
"They're a lot safer now than they were before," Jeb said, his humor fading away. He didn't know what a veek was, but he didn't like being called one. It was something about the former sheriff's tone.
"If it makes you feel better, once we catch the guy, I'll leave the orphanage running. I'll put someone who actually likes children in charge."
Zlesk opened his mouth to respond when Mrs. Lang approached from the front of the mansion, her expression alarmed.
"They're kicking at the door, and their arm... Ah!"
Mrs. Lang was bodily pushed aside, and two Keegan in snazzy black robes with silver trim oriented on Jeb.
their gazes traveling down to his missing leg, then back up to his face.
Jebediah Trapper? The one in the lead asked. That's me, Jeb said. You're under arrest on suspicion of reaping.
They stepped forward and hauled Jeb to his feet, twisting his arms behind him.
Well, it looks like our reaper has political presence. Shit. This just got complicated and dangerous.
Zlesk, Plan C, Jeb hissed. You didn't get around to telling me any plan, Zlesk said, watching Jeb get dragged away with an amused expression. Let alone Plan C.
Ask Mrs. Lang,
Jeb shouted, craning his neck to peer through the doorway as the goons dragged him outside. The last thing he saw was Lesk waving him off.
If you're a citizen, you have the right to legal counsel and will not be required to testify against yourself. Citizenship also confers the right to request the use of a truth seeker in matters both criminal and civil in nature.
So what do I get if I'm not a citizen? Jeb asked, to which the response was a swift cuff on the ear.
Yeah, I thought so, Jeb muttered, ear stinging as they shoved him into the carriage.
At least alien jail was relatively cushy. It all came down to accommodating species that were on average a foot taller than humans were. That meant there was plenty of legroom in both the carriage and the bed. Usually you hear stories about tiny cots and cramped spaces, but when humans were midgets, size wasn't an issue. This bed probably wouldn't fit Zlesk, though, Jeb thought, stretching his toes down to the bottom of the jail cot and his arms over his head. He glanced up at the ceiling, a familiar sense of unease knocking on the door to his thoughts.
Nope.
Jeb turned on to his side and closed his eyes. He didn't have anything to do but wait for the bad guys to show their faces or get executed for not being a citizen. Hopefully, Plan C would be enough to bail him out of the fire and give them a solid lead to work on. In the meantime, Jeb didn't have anything to do but stew. And practice. Jeb pictured the lessons he'd learned from the principles of mist sensors and behavior programming 101.
A mist trigger is similar to a Prince Rupert's drop mixed with a radio, Jeb thought to himself.
To the uninitiated, a Rupert's drop is when a bit of molten glass is dropped into a bucket of water, creating a teardrop shape with a long, thin tail. While the teardrop portion is rather rigid and tough to break, the long tail is brittle and can easily be snapped off. When it is, the entire droplet explodes from released tension. Jeb's science teacher in high school didn't let them do their own because teens are stupid. But the sight of Mr. Clemens digging a sliver of glass out of his palm must have made an impression. In this case, the trigger portion was the thin glass tail, connected to the reservoir of pre-programmed mist, which Jeb pictured as the explosive teardrop of tensioned glass. The tricky part was the trigger. Jeb had to make it respond only to specific actions by making it resonate with the events in question, dialing it in like a radio to a specific station. When the right song came on the radio, it would resonate and wiggle the fragile trigger until it broke and unleashed the stored energy. This was the part that required experience and experimentation to get the feel for it, something that had faded from Jeb within moments of being bitten by the snake book thing.
If in the mist dimension, every event has its own unique resonance frequency, I should be able to figure this out. Eventually.
Jeb sat up, cross-legged, opening his palm and consulting his memories of the tutorial. He had some experience setting up mist triggers, even if he was on autopilot during the entire thing. He'd at least been present. Packaging the mist and programming it was easy. Jeb understood programming, or at least understood the concept of predefined actions. Jeb followed the instructions in the book and made a tiny bead of orange-gold mist ready to blow a gentle gust of wind into his face. Creating the trigger was the hard part, as the instructions in the book waxed somewhat metaphorical, giving instructions such as touching the specific strands from the weave of creation, like the spider Vanaxis. Jeb interpreted it to mean quantum radio. He tried to picture himself closing his right hand as a single possibility out of the wide band of possible events on the infinite spectrum of possibilities that could happen. And he pictured the fragile trigger resonating with that single event until it burst. The trigger fired prematurely, blowing a gentle wind into Jeb's face before he'd even thought about closing his hand. Well, at least it triggered on something. Jeb glanced up, and not a single prisoner or guard was paying attention to his antics, and it didn't look like they would anytime soon, probably letting him stew in fear for a while before they started interrogating him. Jeb shrugged and took a deep breath, drawing mist in to fuel his growing core before siphoning it out, forming it into a tight knot. It might take a while, but Jeb was determined to be able to do this on his own. Zlesk Frantel. Zlesk watched as the annoying human was dragged away, looking like a squirming Rabsy pinned between two hunters, his gold inlaid wooden foot beating out a staccato rhythm on the floor. I could just let him get raked over hot coals. I'm fairly sure the human has done something to deserve it. Zlesk glanced out at the human fat monkeys running around wildly outside the kitchen window, screaming obnoxiously and pulling each other's strange hair, completely free of the worry that any minute their safe haven might crumble to the ground due to the machinations of evil men. He could stand to let Jeb suffer, but to allow the orphanage to collapse was not an option he cared to entertain. The murder savant had done something good here, even if it was in service of his hunting. Zlesk sighed and set his chin on his palm. What was Plan C, Mrs. Lang? Mrs. Lang rubbed her disgustingly obese hip and scowled at the retreating sentinel carriage with her disgustingly obese lips.
Right this way.
Mrs. Lang guided him to Jeb's room on the second floor, right next to the staircase and the closest room to the front door. On the nightstand next to the bed was a human electric lamp which Zlesk had never seen before. For a moment he was distracted by the unflickering pure light as Mrs. Lang produced a series of envelopes from the drawer.
Let's see,
she said, flipping through no less than a dozen envelopes until she found the one she was looking for.
Plan C, corrupt government officials,
Mrs. Lang said, opening the letter and spreading it out on the desk. She frowned as she read it.
Use deputy plate and truth seeker to shake the tree. Hire extra manpower from working stiffs to catch what falls out. Deputy plate is under my pillow. Truth seeker is in the nightstand. What a vague plan,
Mrs. Lang said, turning the piece of paper over to check the back for more. It'll work, Zlesk said as he saw what lay under Jeb's pillow. An enforcer's mark, only given to people enforcers had the highest confidence in. Often the kind of people who went on to become enforcers themselves. It allowed a non-citizen to challenge a citizen, and it gave an actual citizen a substantial amount of freedom from censure. Why anyone would give such a thing to Jebediah Trapper was beyond Zlesk. A small part of him knew he could sell it for a small fortune, or leverage it to climb back into society's good graces and right a few wrongs along the way. But it wasn't his. Zlesk stomped down on those quiet desires like a squirming collie as he picked up the mark. He would behave honorably. Or what right did he have to be a citizen in the first place? Jeb.
As your legal counsel, I advise you to admit your wrongdoings before I break the other arm.
The angry Milos interrogator twisted Jeb's left arm up and behind his back, applying just the right torque to make the entire thing feel like it was about to wrench out of every socket he had. Wrist, elbow, and shoulder all screamed in protest as they hovered on the verge of dislocating. Jeb's other arm was busted, having already been through this lovely process.
Okay, okay,
Jeb shouted, slamming the table with his forehead as a way of tapping out, prompting the Milos to ease up on the pressure just a little.
I spied on some of my friends having sex when I was a teenager. I knew it was wrong, but she had the biggest tits I'd ever...
Pop. Jeb's dislocating arm sent an unpleasant echo through his entire body, not to mention the pain.
Oh!
A lot of people think of a tough guy as someone who can muscle through the impulse to scream. But those kind of people don't really exist outside of Hollywood. A real tough guy sticks to the script after the screaming is over.
Scene! And the way they were bouncing was just fan-fucking-tastic!
Jeb shuddered as adrenaline worked through his veins like battery acid. The other detective pulled up Jeb's face and smacked him around, loosening Jeb's teeth a bit and filling the inside of his mouth with coppery blood. Jeb's vision was starting to get a little blurry.
I really hope they get my plan. Shit, why wasn't step one of plan C rescue my ass? Why didn't I write steps?
Ever since your orphanage popped up, kids have started going missing at a prodigious rate. We have it on high authority that they're going missing from your orphanage.
High authority, huh? I wonder who specifically pushed that narrative.
And really, the only time you can enjoy teenage tits completely guilt-free is when you're also a teen. So I figured...
Crack.
Ah!
There goes the other one. Damn it.
Why does he keep talking about tits?
The Mila standing in front of him said, throwing Jeb's face away in disgust.
A great way to think about grueling PT is to have something you can focus on really, really good. I like to think about boobs.
Drill Sergeant Sean Morgan.
The Reaper's legal counsel has arrived,
a Keegan woman said, peeking her head into the claustrophobic room.
Some uptight Keegan guy.
That must be Zalesk, Jeb thought, eyes widening.
Zalesk was going to come in here and flash the badge and totally flip the script on these goons. One look at that and they'd be eating out of his palm.
If I could lift my palm, Jeb thought, glancing down at his slowly swelling arms.
The Reaper? What happened to innocent until proven guilty, lady?
Jeb demanded, burying his excitement.
Thanks, Sue,
the interrogator said, waving her off. The woman gave Jeb a dismissive glance and ducked her head back out the door.
How the royal did this scum get counsel?
The Milas in front of him asked, scratching his head.
I don't know. I know this boy didn't get a message out. He's been by himself since we got him.
The sentinel said he was screaming something about Plan C on the way out.
A grip tightened on Jeb's skull and yanked his head back.
I bet you'd like to talk to your lawyer, wouldn't you?
The Milas behind him demanded while the other one left the room.
I would like that very much,
Jeb said, his first non-boob-related answer since they began.
Well, tough luck, because if your lawyer isn't a citizen, then...
Kroz,
the other Milas said, leaning back in the door.
The dude's a citizen.
Jeb chuckled evilly. The dumbfounded expression on their faces was almost worth the busted arms. Well, no, it wasn't. Not even close. But it did help it hurt less for a couple seconds.
Shit!
Kroz muttered, shoving Jeb's head aside as he went for the door to the interrogation room.
You've got an hour, Reaper scum. Then we start over again.
The two of them stormed out of the room, slamming the door behind them, leaving Jeb blissfully alone. If Jeb could move his arms, he would have steepled his fingers ominously, channeling his inner Hannibal or Kaiser Soze. This was the moment where everything went off the rails for these two. Less than a minute later, the door opened, revealing a Keegan man in plain robes. Notably not Zlesk.
Who the fuck is this guy?
Jeb thought, raising a brow.
Good evening, Mr. Trapper. I am your legal counsel,
the man said, reaching into his robe, presumably for legal documents or a snack or a pen or something. Jeb would have preferred any of those to the foot and a half of razor-sharp steel that emerged from the assassin's robes.
Crap. Well, that can't be good.
Desperately, Jeb reached under the table with his mist and lassoed the man's legs. As soon as the man decided to move at super speeds, it was game over for Jeb. Jeb simply didn't have the nerve to perceive people moving at top speed yet.
I'm here to deliver a mess.
The Keegan flopped backwards, his feet torn out from under him. Mid-fall, the Keegan whipped his arm out as Jeb seized the air in front of himself, creating a cone of telekinetic force. The short blade bounced off the shield and hummed through the air, burying itself in the wall a few inches from Jeb's cheek.
When the going gets tough, the tough starts screaming.
Help!
Jeb shouted at the top of his lungs, leaping out of his chair and yanking himself up with telekinesis. The Keegan hit the ground and drew another blade, swiping at Jeb's feet under the table, cutting the fancy spring-loaded toe off of his expensive Ramond brand prosthetic, which was too dumb to pull itself out of the way. Another sword burst through the underside of the table, showering Jeb and the ceiling with wooden shrapnel and drawing a line of blood across Jeb's good leg.
God damn it, I only got one of those,
Jeb thought, aiming his fancy prosthesis at the table. Jeb's newest idea for the annihilation lens was a void gun. It was a fairly obvious application of two void lenses with a simple oscillation mechanism between them, rapidly shifting the focus of the lens forward and then back. By shifting the focus back and forth rapidly one time, Jeb was able to create a machine that cut a thumb-sized hole through everything between itself and a point about 30 feet out, a machine that was currently embedded in his fancy footwear. Jeb fed a trickle of mist into the annihilation lens, cutting a hole through the assassin's last known location along with the bottom of his heel. Unfortunately, the sound it created wasn't a cool pew-pew, but was rather something akin to a tennis ball traveling out of a plastic tube at high speed, due to air collapsing in around the traveling focal point.
Oh!
The remains of the table on top of the assassin bucked up and swatted Jeb out of the air, sandwiching him against the wall.
What's going on back there?
The sound of feet running outside made it into the tiny room just as Jeb peeked above the edge of the frayed table, pinning him into the corner of the room. In the center of the dimly lit interrogation room, the assassin clutched a bleeding hole in his shoulder, watching Jeb with fury dancing in his eyes.
Stay or go?
Jeb asked, shakily aiming his foot at the attacker. He honestly didn't have any idea what he could do if the man decided to take Jeb out real quick before he fled. There wasn't much he could do at this point. He'd already exhausted the element of surprise, his hidden ace, and his ability with mist in about 5 seconds of combat. But the other guy didn't know that. With a wordless snarl, the assassin drew a cowl over his face, the fabric turning hazy and transparent before he turned and ran, slamming into the door and blowing the interrogators off their feet.
I hope they broke something just now,
Jeb thought sourly as he watched Tweedledee and Tweedledum roll on the floor in agony through the unhinged door. The closer one clutched his wrist where it had been smashed by the handle.
Ha!
Jeb sobered for a moment of thought.
Seems awfully premature to send an assassin after me.
The people who were dealing with the problem Jeb represented had barely begun to exercise their legal options. Why on earth would they default to an assassin when arresting him was pretty much a slam dunk?
Unless the assassin is working for someone else?
From there, it didn't take much effort to figure out who Jeb had pissed off over the last couple months. Most of them, like the sand pirates, were dead already. But Jeb could think of one person in particular that might have both a pulse and an itty-bitty bit of a sore spot in regards to him. Garland Grenor. I wonder if he actually paid the assassin, or just gave him an IOU. Of course, nothing was for certain, but it made a lot more sense than the Reaper sending a hitman after him when Jeb was a relative unknown who was already being taken care of.
Oh, well, when I see the assassin again, I'll kick his ass.
Her ass?
Wait, what did they look like?
Jeb's memory of the entire time before the man pulled down his translucent cowl showed him a blurred face. Jeb's only clue was that the assailant was a Keegan male. Probably, judging by the clothes.
Goddamn magic hoods. Now he can walk right up and try to shiv me again. For that matter, why did the assassin try to kill me now when he probably assumed I'd be killed on Reaper charges in less than a week?
Coal Region.
That was stupid.
Cole muttered, staunching the wound in his shoulder as he leaned against the wall of his room at the inn. He'd assumed the human would be easy pickings after being worked over for an hour by the local police. Slip in, take the impact, slip back out, easy as harsh spice. Cole knew he could have waited for the human to get convicted and executed and call the job done, but he got lazy and greedy. He wanted to cut his time in Solnath short and hated missing out on levels. All those motivations convinced him that killing a human with two broken arms would be easy. And it should have been. "Fucker hit a wand in his leg," Cole muttered as he disinfected the needle and thread in a Malaysian morose. The drink was only good as a disinfectant slash fire starter slash explosive anyway. "Fucker's also a mist user, which would have been nice to know, Grenoa." Cole shook his head. "My job, my responsibility. He should have done more research into this Jebediah Trapper, but he was a human. Why bother?" There, laziness popping up again. Unless it was one of the few humans that miraculously survived the impossible tutorial, they couldn't hold a candle to Cole's power. At least hypothetically. Cole had memorized the list just in case, too, and there was no Jebediah Trapper on it. Apparently, I was wrong. Should have charged more. Cole hissed with pain as he began sewing the wound shut. Now I've got a big-ass hole in my shoulder because I was lazy. Lesson learned. Cole's new strategy was to hang around Solnath and heal until they executed the human, then call it a job well done. And if he doesn't get executed, I'm going to have to reevaluate my strategy. That nagging tug from Cole's class continued to point out the location of his prey, even as he finished dressing the wound. He wasn't moving. Excellent. Jeb. Once the assassin was gone, the two detectives asked some rather pointed questions about who the man was, and while Jeb had some idea, he couldn't say anything for sure without possibly lying. Of course, these questions eventually turned toward why there was a 24-foot hole in the floor, and not being able to directly lie, this led to Jeb's improvised weaponry being confiscated. Several hours into the second round of questioning, there was another knock on the door.
"Boys, there's another man here who says he's the Reaper's legal counsel," the Keegan woman said, peeking her head into the room.
"Oh, come on,"
Cross shouted, dropping the pliers from Jeb's fingernail.
"We haven't time for another imposter masquerading as a citizen. The judge is breathing down my neck to have this confession ready to turn in tonight."
The judge? Jeb thought, barely cognizant enough to catch that little slip.
"I'm sorry, he's just really, really insistent. Do you think you could—"
"I'll deal with him,"
Camart said, setting down the salt and heading for the door.
"Out of the way,"
a familiar voice said before the secretary was roughly shoved out of the way. Zlesk barged into the room, whipping the enforcer's mark in front of him like he was a priest warding off Dracula. It seemed to have the same effect as the Milos detectives recoiled in horror, minus the hissing.
"Sit down,"
Zlesk said, speaking with the authoritative tone of someone who'd been studying to be sheriff half his life. The two Milos flopped down on either side of the new table, their knees folding out from under them.
"You guys okay in there? Should I get help?"
the secretary asked through the door Zlesk closed with his foot.
"We're fine,"
Kraz raised his voice.
"All good in here,"
Camort shouted, eyes fixed to the mark.
"Okay, then."
From the tone, Jeb could picture the woman shrugging and turning away.
"Excellent. Let's begin,"
Zlesk said, pocketing the enforcer's mark.
"What took you so long?"
Jeb asked.
"Your friend haggled for a great sum in exchange for his assistance. He seemed rather doubtful that we were working together."
"God damn it, Ron,"
Jeb groaned. His haggling cost Jeb a couple fingernails. Do those even grow back?
"You two know each other?"
Cross asked, glancing between the two of them.
"Indeed,"
Zlesk said, coming up behind Jeb and patting him on the shoulder before leaning forward to whisper in Jeb's ear.
"Let me handle this. They'll respond much better to a Keegan citizen with a mark than a maimed human."
Jeb grunted.
It was about as much mental effort as he could devote to any one thing at the moment.
This, detectives, is my fat, ignorant patsy.
Jeb grunted again.
A juicy, wriggling grub to catch a freak. He's no more guilty of trafficking children than you or I.
Jeb smacked his split lips and tried to work up some unbloodied saliva. This part was important.
Judge, confession.
Jeb struggled to speak, his voice hoarse from screaming.
Oh?
Zlesk said, peering at Jeb, then to the two detectives gradually paling from orange to yellow under the former sheriff's scrutiny.
Is there a particular judge driving the investigation against my friend here?
Zlesk reached out and lifted Detective Cross one-handed and stuck him to the ceiling with his class ability. He took the man's seat and sat down in front of Camward, still a head taller than him.
Gentlemen, perhaps you don't understand the gravity here. This judge of yours has already taken my bait. Defending him will bind your fate to his, and there is only one fate for a reaper. Now,
Zlesk steepled his fingers in the exact way Jeb wanted to, staring down the flustered detective.
Do you want to live?
Chapter 19. The Trial. They spilled their guts in every way but the literal way. The judge's name was Miras Elker, and he'd suddenly grown a give-a-shit for the sanctity of human life sometime between the night before last and now. Out of nowhere, the Keegan judge had leaned on the detective's boss, who had leaned on them to retrieve Jeb and squeeze a confession out of him. In an era where truth-seekers existed, forced confessions were still a thing. Go figure. If they made Jeb admit to reaping children, they could formally ask him in court if he'd admitted to the crime, which the truth-seeker would identify as the truth. Then they would pack up and call it a day. What kind of dystopian bullshit is that? The legal system needs to get its ass ironed out. Jeb understood the concept that sometimes people just needed someone to blame. But forcing a false confession when it would be just as easy to get the real bad guy by using a truth-seeker? According to Zlesk, this was a custom unique to Solnath and Judge Elkor in particular, but Jeb had his doubts. Well, tick the corrupt government official box, Jeb thought to himself, trying not to move too much. Moving hurt. With how slimy this judge was looking to an outside observer, it wasn't a stretch to think his dirty laundry would be pretty bad. Child trafficking / murdering bad? Time will tell.
Send me back to the cell,
Jeb muttered through his swollen lip.
Jeb, you need to get some rest. I already paid your bail. I can take you back to the orphanage.
No, I have to stay in jail to stick to the story. These guys can detect a setup. As long as the detectives tell the story we want them to tell, they'll think their little tactic is working until we have a chance to meet them face to face.
What about the guy who tried to kill you?
Zlesk asked. Jeb shrugged.
It'll help me sleep.
Zlesk cocked a brow at this, then turned back to the detectives.
When is the trial?
Tomorrow.
No wasting any time, are they? That's abnormally fast,
Zlesk said, rubbing his chin.
Well, it works well for our plans, too.
He directed his gaze back up to Tweedledee and Dumb.
Do not speak of the mark. If you do, I will find out. If you are questioned about the events that transpired here, describe me as a pushy, unscrupulous lawyer hired by the Reaper with the last vestiges of his money.
Yes, sir,
the detectives said, nodding vigorously.
Make sure he makes it to solitary. And put a security detail on him to make sure he doesn't sustain any more damage.
Zlesk,
Jeb groaned. He didn't need a bunch of people standing around staring at him to make sure he didn't stub his toe.
I'm not budging on that one, so deal with it.
Blah.
Come on, I'll help you, Zlesk said, lifting Jeb to his foot, where Jeb stood woozily in place, unable to take a step. What's wrong? Zlesk asked, frowning.
They took my foot.
Jeb mewled. Actually mewled. Jeb's face crumpled up and he tried not to ugly cry from relief. The stress of getting tortured for an entire afternoon burst out in an unexpected way.
I just got it too, and it already needs to be fixed.
There. Zlesk awkwardly patted Jeb on the back, seemingly unsure of what to do. Jeb took a shuddering breath.
I'm fine. It's just a dopamine crash from the torture,
Jeb said, waving him off and wiping his face.
I would like my foot back, though.
Sir, that prosthesis contained a Schedule 1 improvised annihilation mist weapon, which are illegal,
Dee said.
Like, really illegal,
Dumb chimed in.
Did it enter the official record yet?
The two Milas glanced at each other.
No.
Then you didn't find it. Bring my fat Patsy's foot back, right now.
I'm not fat,
Jeb muttered.
You are to me, Zlesk said, patting him on the back more naturally this time. Come on, let's hop your way back to your cell.
Ow, ow, ow!
Jeb hissed as Zlesk tried to get an arm under him. Jeb's arms had been worked over so good that they didn't want to do anything in particular but rest in a sling for a couple weeks.
Hold on. I'll do it myself,
Jeb muttered, hardening a pig leg out of telekinetic force and putting it under a stump. He gingerly put his weight on it and was pleased when he didn't fall on his face. He had to move it mentally rather than physically, which presented extra difficulty when his concentration lapsed, but he managed it. Jeb split the thread of mist into two and used the other one to grab himself by the diaphragm, steadying his balance. It was a bit like riding a unicycle and juggling, but it worked. Jeb walked out of the room with one foot and no arms. Admittedly, he walked very slowly and laboriously, but he walked. Just a few more deals and I'll be flying again. Jeb sat down on his bed in solitary, gladly accepting his fancy foot back. The toe was crudely glued back on, and it would probably snap off from the pressure of walking in a matter of hours, but Jeb was happy to have it. He slipped the prosthetic back into its proper place on his stump with a grateful sigh before tightening the straps and flopping down on his bed.
I'll see you tomorrow, Jebediah, Zlesk said.
Tomorrow,
Jeb said, waving a hand and closing his eyes. Once Zlesk was gone, Jeb opened his eyes again, studying the cracks in the ceiling. The sheer amount of stress he'd endured today had basically tired out his amygdala until it was numb, allowing him to look at a ceiling like any other person might. It was a small island in time where he simply couldn't feel the slowly encroaching fear. It was nice. Jeb wanted to feel the scar on his palm to reassure himself, but his fingers were swollen, which was a good change. As long as things continued to change in a way that made sense, Jeb could convince himself he wasn't in some kind of nightmare hell loop. It'd been years, but echoes of that strange cyclical thinking still came back to haunt him every now and then. But not tonight. Tonight, he had the soothing pain of broken arms and the stress of a botched assassination to lull him to sleep, to prove this wasn't all in his head.
I'm really messed up, aren't I?
Jeb muttered to the ceiling.
Yep,
Smartass said solemnly, patting him on the cheek. Jeb only got about 5 hours of sleep before the sentinels roused him in order to make him more presentable. They put his more damaged left arm in splints and a sling, while his dislocated right arm got some tightening wraps around the joints to help them stay in place while they healed. They gave him a mildly magical tea that brought the swelling down substantially and slipped him into a Keegan-style robe to make him look more official, maybe? Between getting his leg back and the loner walking stick, Jeb was able to totter his way to court without assistance, except for getting out of the carriage. He had some difficulty navigating the marble staircase under the gawking gazes of the spectators, but he managed. All the while, Jeb kept his eyes open for the Keegan assassin. The chances of the guy coming back for more immediately when he had a hole in his shoulder were slim, but Jeb didn't intend to be caught off guard again. Jeb was led to a seat in the center of the room by the firm hand of one of the sentinels, who remained standing beside him, arms clasped in front. Jeb sat in the uncomfortable chair and waited as audience members streamed in around him, taking seats on tiered bleachers that stretched around the central court, like this was a Roman gladiatorial match. As if this was the most entertaining thing they were going to see all week. They have no idea, Jeb chuckled. Once the audience was in, he kept his eye open for anything akin to a jury, but he didn't even see a separate spot for one. That's not a good sign. Once everyone was more or less settled, the guy standing next to him shouted, "Please rise for the Honorable Judge Elcor." Jeb really wanted to stay seated to make a statement and prove how cool he was under pressure, but that didn't really serve any purpose other than to irritate the judge and stir shit up. Jeb didn't need the man angry to start. He needed him calm and confident. Gotta keep an animal calm and relaxed before you slaughter it. Spoils the meat otherwise. So he stood along with the rest of the crowds as the judge sauntered in, preening under the gaze of hundreds of citizens of Solnath. Jeb idly touched the supplies in his breast pocket to make sure they were still there. Tweedledee had passed the copper plate and gold earring to him when they were getting Jeb dressed. Ron's zombies were outside, posing as day labor and common rats. Once Jeb shook this tree, the semi-autonomous creatures would follow the audience and eavesdrop on their conversations. That should allow Ron to point Zlesk in the right direction. Then Zlesk and Colt smash. Thinking of Colt, Jeb was tempted to rub his eyebrows. The boy obviously had an excellent magic for crowd control, but he kept trying to 1v1 everyone. He needed to embrace the chaos.
"Thank you, my friends,"
Judge Elcor said, waving as he sat down at the raised dais in front of Jeb.
"You may be seated."
Jeb put his butt to wood along with several dozen others.
"We gather today for the trial and sentencing of the Reaper responsible for the death of so many human children here in Somnath."
The judge bowed his head in what Jeb assumed was a show of sadness. The audience, roughly a third human, booed and hissed. A camera flash went off, and then a battery sailed down and bounced off Jeb's wounded shoulder, drawing a hiss out of him.
"Well, the crowd seems to already have their mind made up," Jeb thought, scanning them.
Getting humans involved in law proceedings was a great way to integrate them as a whole, but Jeb didn't want to be the scapegoat to make that happen.
"Silence!"
Elcor rumbled, waving his hand dismissively. A pulse of sea-green mist hit the crowd in a matter of seconds. They quieted down, placidity recovered.
"Let's begin."
Elcor clacked a pair of sticks together, each bound by rich red rope with a golden tassel. Perhaps the off-world equivalent of a gavel?
"Bailiff, will you read the charges?"
The Milos beside him held up a scroll and cleared his throat.
"Ahem. Jebediah Thrapa stands accused of trafficking children with intent to reap. Reaping, owning and operating."
The bailiff was cut off when a baby in the stands went from fussy to literally bursting into flames, engulfing its mother in a pyre. Thankfully, the woman had seated herself carefully, close to the exit and surrounded by Milos. No damage was done except for the smoke smudge on the stone ceiling.
"Madam, get that baby out of my court,"
Judge Elcor said, pointing to the door. The walking pillar of fire nodded and left while the surrounding Milos poked fun at the baby for throwing a tantrum. The bailiff cleared his throat again.
"Owning and operating an orphanage without a permit. Failure to register no less than 6 slaves with the Office of Labor and the abuse thereof. That is all,"
the bailiff said, closing the scroll.
"Wow," Jeb muttered. "Way to make me look like an asshole, which I suppose is the point."
"Jebediah Trapper,"
Elcor said, his gaze boring into Jeb's skull.
You are scum. I wish I could punish you separately for each of your crimes, but we all know there is only one punishment for reaping. So this court will decide the matter of reaping and trafficking first, then execute the penalty.
Yeah, woo, punishment!
Ron shouted from the spectator stands, throwing another battery at Jeb, bouncing it off the arm in a splint.
God damn it, Ron.
The necromancer's acting was far too enthusiastic, but he was in the middle of an angry mob and inhumans. They weren't looking for bad acting.
Quiet!
Judge Elcor said, clacking his important sticks together.
Bring out the confession!
A nearby Milos secretary ran up to the judge and whispered in his ear.
What do you mean there's none?
He growled, then looked down at Jeb's bruised and battered form.
You're an irritating man, Jebediah Threpper.
So I've been told. Jeb bowed his head.
I apologize. I wanted to— You do not have permission to speak!
Elcor shouted over him. A wave of sea green rolled over Jeb, settling into his bones. Everything seemed to dim for a moment, every muscle in his body relaxing as he lost control over them. His jaw, on the other hand, seemed to tense up, locking into place and preventing him from speaking. A moment later, Jeb's core flared and shrugged off the effects of the mist. In this scenario, Jeb was an unruly cat, and the judge was the human. The man had a great deal more raw power than Jeb did, but the judge had budgeted the spell, expecting a gerbil. Judge Elcor stared at him with furrowed brows as Jeb shook off the magic and flexed his jaw, rubbing out the cramp. Jeb deliberately chose not to speak, respecting the conventions of the court.
Gotta keep the meat calm.
He glanced at the bailiff and tugged the man's sleeve.
I believe the Reaper would like to speak,
the bailiff said. Judge Elcor studied Jeb for a moment, then subtly arranged a shield of sea-green energy around himself, presumably to stop Jeb from messing with his head, as if that was a thing Jeb could do.
The court recognizes Jebediah Trapper.
Jeb carefully arranged the words in his mind to be both entirely truthful and deceitful as all hell. It was harder than it sounded.
I apologize for the inconvenience. I understand how bad my situation is. See, back on my home planet, there were these things called plea bargains. I know that without an extraordinary event, I'm definitely going to be convicted. I can see the direction this trial is going. If it would please the court, I would like to offer a deal. I will accept the onus the Empire has placed on me, thereby bringing this trial to a swift end, and in return the judge will answer a question of mine. I have many people I feel deeply responsible for, and would die easier knowing their fate.
There, none of it is a lie.
You would barter for my time,
Judge Elcor said, leaning over his dais, looking down at Jeb with a sneer. Jeb stayed silent. He didn't know if his turn to speak had been revoked, so he just kept his mouth shut. Here it is. If he agrees to the deal, I've already got him by the balls. Jeb had specifically asked for the judge to answer a question. He might have alluded to inquiring about the fate of some of his friends, but that was a red herring in his speech. A true sentence, but unrelated. Jeb's end of the bargain, accepting the onus the Empire had placed on him, was basically just doing what he was already intending to do. Restacalus represented the Empire at a higher level than the judge here did, so the job she'd given him came first, before whatever bogus decision this kangaroo court came to. Translation? I'll continue to look for the Reaper, and in exchange, you answer one question. There's a good fairy deal, Jeb thought, hiding his white knuckles under the table. This was what he kept his prey calm and confident for this entire time. The slaughter.
Huh!
The judge chuckled, leaning back in his seat.
Very well, I accept.
He glanced to the secretary.
Let the record show that Mr. Trapper has admitted to his crimes.
Click.
And for my part of the deal?
Jeb said, his trembling fingers fishing into his front pocket.
I will send a messenger to your cell after the trial is over.
Actually, I'd like to get my answer right now. Jeb said, dropping the enforcer's mark on the table in front of him. My onus is to find and kill the Reapers operating out of Solmnath, a task which was given to me by Imperial Enforcer Vresk Tikalis. The copper plate clattered to a halt in front of Jeb to the sound of utter silence from all but the humans, who whispered to their Milos and Keegan neighbors. The whispering spread outward, surrounding Jeb with murmurs as he tried to get his fingers to grab the earring in his pocket without hurting the nail bed.
What is this?
Judge Elcor demanded, scowling at the plate that signified Jeb was acting on behalf of an enforcer.
A trap, I suppose, Jeb said, battered fingers retrieving the truth seeker and clipping it to his ear.
There was a brief prick of pain as the gold pin slid through Jeb's ear, but he ignored it.
My question is this, Jeb said, pointing to his ear. Have you, Judge Elcor, aided or abetted the trafficking or reaping of human children?
The judge leaned back and took a breath. There were a few possible ways Jeb saw this going. One, the other guy does a full court press to discredit Jeb. The most likely. Two, he clams up and says nothing in order to minimize damage. Three, he straight up bolts. Four, he tries to kill Jeb.
This man is a thief or a liar,
Elcor shouted, rising to his full 7-foot height and pointing at Jeb with the tasseled mega chopsticks.
No human would be trusted with an enforcer's mark. Confiscate it from him immediately.
Option one, then. The bailiff made a reachy reach for Jeb's copper plate, and Jeb aimed his newest invention at him from under the table. Favoring non-lethal takedowns when dealing with people, Jeb had weaponized the hopelessness lens. The hopelessness lens looked like legal documents, past due letters and bright red eviction notices all crumpled into a tight wad. Impossible to tease out exactly who or what they were for. It gave off incredibly soft whimpers that were only audible to those with mist. Fueled by Jeb's mist, the stubby wand shot out a red-streaked beige beam that emerged from the table and caught the bailiff full in the chest. The Milos curled into a ball next to the table and started crying.
The question, have you, Judge Elcor, aided or abetted the trafficking or
hidden weapons?
Elcor shouted over Jeb.
He's an assassin sent to kill me!
Jeb felt his ear twitch. The judge pointed the tassel things at Jeb again, but this time they were crackling with sea-green power. A lot more than last time. I do believe that's more than enough to kill me. So, a combination of option one and four? Jeb thought, desperately spinning up his mist to attempt to weather the effect of Elcor's enervation. The beam of sea-green mist traveled across the room and impacted against a similar beam of neon purple directly in front of Jeb. The two rays of magic scattered into a brilliant display of mist fireworks only visible to three of the hundreds of spectators. In the stands, Ron blew imaginary smoke off the tip of his finger like an idiot. The kid was the only other person from the impossible tutorial who full stop dedicated himself to mist, and that meant his magic was strong. Judge Elcor stared at Jeb's companion, slack-jawed. A random human's mist had just wiped the floor with his own presumably third-generation mist core. The judge's eyes were bugging out. Seems like a good opportunity to pose my question again.
The question, Mr. Elcor, is have you aided or abetted the
outrageous lies and slander?
The judge shouted over Jeb again, making his ear twitch as he lied. As a tactic, talking over people was actually a pretty good way of preventing them from being heard, if crude and juvenile. Effective, though.
I'll have none of it in my courtroom. This session is adjourned until we have a chance to search the Reaper for hidden weapons and teach him some respect. This Reaper is guilty of the murder of children for freshness' sake.
Is anybody else wondering why he doesn't just answer the question?
Ron asked in the middle of the slowly heating mob, his voice pitched up just nasal enough to carry through the entire room, somehow finding a chink in the judge's armor of boisterous bellowing.
What question?
Someone asked aloud.
Did someone ask the judge a question?
Why is he yelling anyway?
What's that copper thing mean?
God fucking damn it. Of course people were oblivious. Getting everyone on the same page was like herding cats. Jeb stood and filled his lungs.
Mirzas Elcor, have you aided or abetted in the trafficking or reaping of human children?
Jeb bellowed with every ounce of training and clarity he could muster. One thing the army teaches you is how to scream in such a way that people can still understand you. It rarely came in handy, but this was one such occasion, forcing the judge to lean away and shutting him up, albeit temporarily.
The judge did?
Wait, so this is a sting?
Chris Hansen, eat your heart out!
Why don't you take a seat?
The judge scanned the crowd, turning a light shade of blue.